This is your brain on censorship. I think that most censorship takes place internally and is not externally, explicitly externally imposed. I'm very comfortable. No. I don't think I can make that assertion. I don't think I'm not comfortable. I'm just not comfortable making assertions about censorship. Which is the point? The point is that I think most censorship, like most oppression, it's been said that 90% of oppression is consensual, by which it's meant that, well, there's a line in the battered women's movement, which is one good beating lasts a year. And that's what Judith Herman said about that, is that if the beating is strong enough, if the woman sees in the man's eyes, I could kill you, that's enough to keep, that can be enough to keep many women in line for a year. And then it has to be reinforced. And I mean, this is the notion of the quote, happy slaves too, that those in power cannot be everywhere imposing their will upon everyone through force. So if you're going to have all these enslaved peoples working in a field, it's not efficient to have all of them in chains. You can have one or two in chains. It's the spectacle of terror. But for the most part, you rely upon them to police themselves. And the same is true with censorship, that most censorship does not take place because somebody with a submachine gun walks through the newsroom and says, okay, so, you know, I was a young environmentalist when the whole jobs versus owls debate was really going on. And all the newspapers were putting it that, gosh, spotted owls are driving loggers out of business. And they're driving mill workers out of business. And they're making them so all unemployed. And even though I was a baby environmentalist, I still knew the facts that the cut had gone up all through the 80s. But the number of jobs went down because of raw log exports and because of automation. But the corporate press never talked about that. And that's not because somebody with a machine gun walked through the newsroom saying, don't you dare mention raw log exports or automation. What it is they saw that, for example, Richard Manning, lost his job at the Missoulian because he, quote, got too close to his sources. And Richard Manning made the point. He was fired from the Missoulian because he cared about the environment, and his articles were truthful about the deforestation going on. And he said that they never say that when you're working with a politician or when you're working with business people, you are, quote, getting too close to your sources. That instead is cultivating your sources. So when members of the press corps could play tennis with the president, this is back during the Obama era and Clinton, they certainly played tennis with all of them. That was considered cultivating the sources as opposed to getting too close to them. So the point is, all you have to do is see Dick Manning get fired, and that can have a very strong effect on everybody else. I mean, that was the purpose. That was the primary purpose of lynching, was not to simply express hatred. It wasn't blind hatred they were expressing. Instead, it was political theater. That if we can, if one person goes and takes, if one person who is working the land takes his cotton in, and if he's African American, and this is 1870, takes his cotton in, and they offer him less than they offer white people, and he complains, well, all you have to do is spectacularly kill him, and that will keep everybody else in line. The other people will self-censor. When they get to the store, they will take what you offer. And so the actual, we're going to beat your brains in censorship only has to happen a little bit to make everybody else stay in line. And I mean, I can't tell you in the whole having to do with the whole women's only spaces and having to do with the transgender issue, I can't tell you how many women have said to me, I can't talk about this issue. Either I can't talk about this issue in public because if I do, I'll lose my job. And so I have seen women who very strongly feel that there should be only, that there should be women's only spaces, who have taken public stances apologizing for having ever said there should be public women's spaces. Excuse me. Apologizing for having ever said that there should be women's only spaces and apologizing for calling males who identify as transgender males. Publicly apologizing for that because they don't want to lose their jobs. And this, I mean, as people may know, I had a book that was supposed to come out in November, and the publisher in August pulled the book, and he pulled the book because I dared to critique queer theory. And he didn't even cite anything that I had said. He said, I can't find anything you said that is inaccurate, but it is, to put his words, a misuse of truth to say these things, whatever that means. But my real point is, how many people having their books not get published because they criticize queer theory, how many of those does it take before other people won't even bother to try to critique queer theory? That's the point. And there are two things going on. One is, you know, the sheer sort of spectacle of terror of, if you say this thing, you will get killed, or if you say this thing, you will lose your job. There's the stick. And there's also the carrot that Lewis Mumford talked about, how one of the reasons that we all go along with this culture is because of what he called the magnificent bribe. We've talked about this before, that only the sort of ham-fisted dictators only use the threat of terror to keep people in line. What works much better is you use the threat of terror, and at the same time, you extend a hand to give them things if they go along with your ideology. It's very interesting. I was reading, this a few years ago, I was reading an analysis of why a lot of people joined the Nazi Party in Germany. And a significant portion of the population joined the Nazi Party, not because they agreed with the ideology, but instead because there were jobs that were only open to members of the party. So they would, engineers, for a lot of engineers, for example, had to be Nazis in order to work and just do their job as engineers, not do their jobs as engineers working for the Wehrmacht or working in a concentration camp, but just to work as an engineer, you had to be a Nazi. So a lot of them would simply self-censor. And it's very interesting to watch these processes take place, at least for me, and at least inside, that one can easily say, okay, I'm going to sign up that I'm a Nazi, but I'm not going to believe any of it, and I'm doing this just for the job. And then it can be very easy to then, having taken on the robe, as the Jesuits say, if you get in the position of prayer, eventually you'll feel like praying. And it's the same thing, that if you assume the mantle of Nazism, then eventually you might start taking on some of the ideology. So that self-censorship in order to gain a position can be really can infiltrate all of your being. And the same is true with the stick as well, that in order to survive a victim of abuse, if someone is in an abusive relationship, in order to survive, the victim must actually pay closer attention to the perpetrator's feelings than their own. Because if I'm in a relationship with an abuser and if I am essentially powerless, my feelings don't matter. What are important at every moment are the perpetrator's feelings, because those are the ones that can kill me. And so if you're in that position, this is on a sort of base level how that identification with the oppressor can take place. That if you are self-censoring to stay alive, or if you're self-censoring to maintain your job, or to gain a better position, it doesn't matter. The best way you can do that is by anticipating what they want and giving it to them before they want it. And so if you do that enough, it can become a habit. It can become a characteristic. It can become a part of your life. It can become you, so that you put on a mask, and at some point that mask can stick to your face, and you're no longer at that point. Are you self-censoring? There's a great line by Upton Sinclair: it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on not understanding it. We can also say it's hard to make people understand something when their lives depend on them not understanding it. And I'm thinking also of this great line by this great discussion by R.D. Lang about how if Jack and Jill are in some sort of relationship and Jack forgets something, that's no good if Jill keeps reminding him of it. And so he has to make her forget too. And he can do that through beating her. He can do that through getting mad at her when she brings it up. He can get her to forget by making her feel guilty, by telling her it didn't happen. And again, this all speaks to how the censorship starts externally, but it can quickly become internalized, and then it can quickly become so internalized that you no longer realize you're doing it. This is how, I mean, I mentioned this previously too, but you know, recently there was an op-ed in the New York Times about how would it be a bad thing for humans to go extinct? And the thing I found extraordinary about it is that the New York Times could contemplate human extinction because of this way of life, but it couldn't contemplate ending this way of life even in order to prevent human extinction. And that's what I'm talking about when we talk about this self-censorship, that this way of life has insinuated itself so strongly into our beings that we can contemplate the very extinction of our species and perhaps the extirpation of all life on the planet before we can contemplate ending this way of life. That's the level to which we self-censor. And the solution, I mean, I'm perhaps not the one to talk about a solution to this, because I have never, I mean, sure, I self-censor like we all do. And the primary ways I self-censor, I have no idea what they are, because if the self-censorship is really successful, then you don't even know you're doing it. It's like denial. How do I know what I'm in denial about? Because I'm in denial. I mean, what I want to say for the self-censorship is for us to have the courage to simply speak the truth. But part of the problem, there's a couple problems. One of them is that the self-censorship is so deep that when we're confronted with it somehow, I think our response is to attempt to stop those who are, to do the Jack and Jill thing, and attempt to stop those who are reminding us that we're self-censoring. And another part of the problem is that, well, I think we understand the problems now. I think the solution, as I understand it to be, I have said many times that the task of a writer is to articulate the things that the writer knows in his or her heart are true, but to which that person has not yet, but which that person has not yet been able to articulate. And in so doing, to help other people to articulate the things that they know in their heart are true, but to which they've not yet been able to put words. But there is something before that. I think the direction to go has to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, in that I think step one is to acknowledge there's a problem. So before we can end self-censorship by telling the truth, I think the first thing we have to do is to acknowledge that we are self-censoring, and to acknowledge why and how we're self-censoring, and then to move out from there.